Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's what you need to know about the details of the Obama administration's mortgage rescue plan that were released today. You probably don't qualify, but maybe the family next door will, or the one around the corner or down the block, and the White House is betting that is going to turn the economy around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing people-ready enterprise solutions, software based on how people really work. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today is Wednesday, the 4th of March. Good to have you here. There are plus or minus 50 million mortgage holders in this country. The plan the Treasury Department took the wraps off today should help, again, plus or minus about 9 million of them. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will refinance about half that total, homeowners who owe more than their houses are worth. And the government will pay billions to help the rest, those who can't make their payments. From Washington Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
No one likes the idea of bailing out people who bought houses they couldn't afford. And after President Obama unveiled the outlines of his plan 2 weeks ago, some folks got angry. So today, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs had a simple message.
This is not going to save every person's home.
Gibbs said people who bought houses they clearly could never afford won't get help. But
the president laid out that a plan that for the very first time offers help for those that have played by the rules and acted responsibly.
The first part of the plan will help some homeowners who have seen the equity in their homes evaporate and now can't refinance. The second part pays lenders and loan servicers thousands of dollars to reduce interest rates and even principal on loans that are in danger of defaulting, but only if working out these loans ends up saving the banks money.
And I'm really seeing the meat on the bone, finally, of something that's I think is really going to have a massive impact on these foreclosures.
John Taylor is president of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Susan Wachter teaches real estate at Wharton. She also sees a lot she likes in these proposals, but
we cannot rely on this alone to bring us recovery in the housing market.
The trouble is, one in five homeowners now owe more on their home than it's worth. And in Nevada, Florida, and California, tens of thousands of homeowners are too far underwater to qualify for the refinancing plan unveiled today. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The housing market aside, Wall Street got a little bump today, and there are a couple of ways to account for that. One, the day after back-to-back 12-year lows, what's not to love about stock prices, right? So people were in a buying mood. Two, stimulus. Not ours, though, the Chinese, and the possibility of Beijing making a big add-on to the half-trillion-dollar stimulus package it announced back in November. That plan hasn't really done much so far, but the logic today, such as it is, goes something like this, that if you can just get Chinese demand going again, that'll somehow kickstart the rest of the global economy, too. We asked Ashley Milne-Tite to see if the idea can stand closer inspection.
Much of the money in the first package went to infrastructure and construction. Barry Norton is a professor of the Chinese economy at the University of California, San Diego. He expects the latest stimulus will be aimed more at businesses and consumers. He says it won't have a direct effect on the U.S. economy.
I think what it really does is it makes it much less likely that the two countries will get into economic conflict, and it gives China time to bring down its surplus, a trade surplus, by stimulating the domestic economy.
That surplus was fueled by foreigners buying Chinese goods. That's happening a lot less these days. Donald Strassheim heads Strassheim Global Advisors. He says if the Chinese start spending more, the U.S. could get a small boost.
But it is a fantasy for us to think that their stimulus package is going to be a material lift to our economic future.
He says China just doesn't buy enough from us to make a big difference. Ben Carliner is director of research at the Economic Strategy Institute. He says if the Chinese build more, demand for raw materials should help commodity producers like Australia and Brazil, but not much.
In the long run, it really depends on the recovery of the global economy to really create the demand that's going to cause prices to rise again in commodity markets. And so far, the news has been unrelentingly bad.
Carliner says the world's economic problems are too large for China to make much of a dent. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
I don't know. Maybe yesterday was the bottom for this bear market. Or maybe it wasn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has been a busy guy today. As Steve Henn told us up at the top of the program, he released the details of the administration's mortgage relief plan this morning, and he's been up on Capitol Hill defending the president's budget today, too. It's a budget that's heavy on the expense side of the ledger book. The White House is betting that government spending will be good for the economy and the country's long-term health. The idea here, something called the multiplier effect, is another contribution from the theories of John Maynard Keynes. But commentator David Frum says, in this case, theory and practice are pretty far apart.
If you are under 40 and not a professional economist, I wonder whether you had ever even heard the phrase economic multiplier before this month. The concept got its last big airing during the slow growth 1970s. Since World War II, economists of the Keynesian school had argued that government spending exerted a bigger impact on stimulating economic activity than private spending, a bigger multiplier. Government could borrow and spend, and so long as it spent intelligently, the spending would actually go a long way to paying for itself by expanding the overall economy. The multiplier effect was the liberal equivalent of the Laffer curve, the conservative promise that the government could cut taxes without losing revenue. The Keynesian argument was not wrong, exactly. It was just that we began to run out of good things to buy. An I-95 or an O'Hare airport, yes, they probably added more to the economy than they cost. But public housing, synthetic fuels, Boston's big dig? Not so much. Through the 1970s, resurgent free market economists showed that public spending typically yielded much worse results than private investment. Government still spent a lot, but more and more of that spending supported government's current operations, defense, healthcare, pensions. After a generation of this priority shift, the nation's airports, roads, and bridges have begun to look a little tired. And the nation's Keynesian economists have begun to feel a little bolder. The chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors speculated in a recent paper that with today's depressed private investment and aging infrastructure, the multiplier on public investment might be higher than ever. On the blackboard, it might even be true. But the Obama administration's plans won't be enacted on a blackboard. High-speed rail in the Boston-Washington corridor might pay off. A maglev train from Disney World to Las Vegas? That's politics, not economics. The trouble with the Obama plans is not that Keynesian ideas are all wrong. The trouble is that even when they are sort of right, governments can't execute them to do more good than harm.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Do take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Although the power players in Washington and New York are still wearing business formal to the office, we got to looking around the other day and wondered whether there isn't a recession chic at play these days, you know, dressing down to reflect the economy. For some fashion help, we've called Kate Betts. She's the editor of Time Style and Design. And Kate, I need you to remind me where we tracked you down.
You have tracked me down in Paris, France, where I'm covering the fall 2009 fashion shows, which start tomorrow morning.
All right, so I've probably never started an interview this way before, but what are you wearing?
You don't want to know. As I said, the show starts tomorrow, not today. I'm actually wearing jeans, which I'm embarrassed to admit.
Well, that's exactly why we called, because not only are you wearing jeans, I'm wearing jeans, my producer's wearing jeans. I mean, we're all looking pretty ratty, and we got to wondering whether it's just us or maybe the economy really is changing how we're looking.
I believe very strongly that it's the exact opposite, and I call it recession dressing. It's time to really make an effort. You can't just sink down into, you know, the depths and think about this gloom and doom. And fashion is something that, you know, traditionally is an escape for people, and I think no more so than right now, people will look to it as an escape.
All right, but you guys are fashion professionals. What about the rest of us? I mean, you know, dressing nicely costs money.
Well, it does cost money, but you know what? Now more than ever, I think there are more outlets where you can buy things at a great price. H&M, Zara, The Gap. I mean, all of these places have really good prices, and they have really fashionable clothing now and accessories, and you can get anything that's in fashion for a good price at this point.
You know, we've talked before, you and I, about how the high end is a driver for the economics of the low end. Does that still apply, even a recession?
It totally does. You always need the high end in any kind of market to inspire the entire market, whether it's the jewelry market, fine jewelry, whether it's the fashion and accessories business, in architecture, in home decor, in, you know, paint colors for wall coverings. Everything has to be inspired by a higher, more refined product that has higher quality production.
How do you translate that, though, when people are losing their jobs, they're trying to figure out how to make the rent, and they have to choose between, you know, a $50 pair of jeans and a $250 pair of jeans?
Well, I think the answer to that is obvious. I mean, people will either buy the $50 pair of jeans or they won't buy anything at all. And the second option is the thing that has luxury executives really panicked, is that the consumers basically close their pocketbook. And when I was in Milan, I was kind of shocked to hear from a few luxury executives that there were certain stores in that city where on a Saturday, for example, and remember, Italians are big consumers of fashion and luxury. They didn't even have one consumer, you know, push the door open to their boutique for the whole day.
All right. Well, listen, since I've got you and since you are a fashion expert, what do you do to dress yourself up a little bit if you're at that lower end of the market like, oh, I don't know, us?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I do feel really strongly about, and this is me waving the flag for the fashion business, but I do think that people who can and want to shop should shop. So I try to buy something, you know, not just to make myself feel better, but I feel like everybody has to contribute and keep the business going. I mean, we are all in business. So there was a message on the runways about big shoulder pads coming back.
And oh, God, kind of, seriously? Big shoulder pads?
The defined shoulder, they call it. Power suits. I think women are going to be wearing armor again. It is kind of like the 80s again, and you do have to sort of feel stronger and more powerful somehow to beat this.
Kate Betts, we tracked her down in Paris. She's the editor of Time, Style, and Design. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
One winner in this recession might just be tourism in the great state of New Jersey. Government officials and real estate agents there say penny-pinching East Coasters are staying nearby, and they're snapping up beach rentals for this coming summer at 2008 prices, I might add. With spring just a couple of weeks away, Wildwood, New Jersey is putting the final touches on a $3.5 million renovation of its oceanfront boardwalk. And so far, so good. But economic development is coming with environmental costs. Wildwood is using imported Brazilian hardwood, Ipe wood it's called. And Joel Rose reports they're not the only beach town doing it.
On a gray day in late winter, Wildwood is pretty much deserted, except for half a dozen guys in hard hats who are rebuilding a three-block stretch of boardwalk, one board at a time.
Unfortunately, what they're using here is uncertified Ipe rainforest wood from Brazil. It's like walking on a coffin.
Georgina Shanley is an environmental activist from Ocean City, New Jersey, about 20 miles away. Shanley thought this was one town she had already persuaded.
About 10 years ago, Wildwood passed a resolution never to use rainforest wood on the boardwalk. It seems like there's a huge addiction of shore towns to rainforest wood, tropical hardwood.
Most of the Ipe wood sold in the U.S. comes from Brazil. And as much as 80% of that wood is harvested in violation of Brazilian law, says Tim Keating, director of Rainforest Relief. He says an acre of rainforest might contain just one or two mature ipe trees.
If you're just hunting down ipe trees, you're bulldozing lots of roads into the forest looking for those ipe trees. It's a huge, huge impact on the forest.
Rainforest Relief tries to persuade U.S. municipalities not to use Ipe for boardwalks and decks, but that can be a tough sell because it's so well-suited to the job.
number one, the density is unbelievably hard. It's almost like iron. And number two, it looks like mahogany.
Ernie Troiano is the mayor of Wildwood. He says ipe is expensive, but it's also more durable than other kinds of wood.
Everywhere you go, they're using ipe. And I'm not saying that makes it right or wrong. What I'm saying is it's a proven product, and it'll last. And that's what I need. I need to get the best bang for my buck.
New York was the first city to use ipe for the boardwalk on Coney Island. Now you can find it all over the country, from Miami Beach to Baltimore's Inner Harbor to Long Beach, California. Mayor Troiano admits that Wildwood violated its own non-binding resolution by turning to ipe, but he says the city did look into alternatives. Wildwood spent $65,000 last fall on a domestic hardwood called Black Locust, but Troiano says the wood just wasn't up to spec, and there was a lot of pressure from merchants to finish the boardwalk on schedule.
If it's not open by Easter, Palm Sunday, all those business owners are not going to be very happy at all. We had to do what we had to do to make sure we got the job done.
The stretch of boardwalk that's under construction happens to be right in front of Maury's Piers, which operates hundreds of amusement park rides and two water parks in Wildwood. Clark Doran is the company's director of planning.
We would be happier if this were Black Locust and it were done right now than ipe or yellow pine or plastic or any of the other materials. The Black Locust seemed like a good solution to us, and we hope it still can be.
Wildwood is planning to redo the rest of its boardwalk over the next few years. The mayor says he'll take another look at the alternatives to ipe, but he's not making any promises. Wildwood, New Jersey, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Coming up, stopping foreclosures one house at a time.
It's a kind of a bowling effect. You hit the front pin, everything starts going, and that's what we're trying to create here.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials bounced off those 12-year lows today, climbed 149 points, 2.25%, finished at 6,875. The NASDAQ gained 32 points, 2.5%, closed at 1353. The S&P 500 up 20 points, nearly 3%, ended the day at 716. Speculation about China's economic stimulus plan we told you about was good news for the commodities business. AK Steel Holdings and Steel Dynamics constructed a 15% gain today. U.S. Steel climbed 10%. Foundation Coal steamed up 6%. Not such good news for banks, though. Wells Fargo rolled back 9%. JPMorgan Chase fell 8%. Citigroup obliged and lost 7%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.98%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the revised fourth quarter productivity and costs report. The House Armed Services Committee discusses combating piracy on the high seas. And the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on AIG. They'll look at what went wrong, government intervention, and implications for future regulation. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's going to be another couple of days before we get the official picture of the February labor market. The jobs report comes out Friday morning. In the meanwhile, though, the payroll processing firm ADP gave us its version today. Almost 700,000 jobs vanished last month. New York Times columnist David Leonhardt writes about unemployment as the key characteristic of this great recession in the paper today. Hi, David.
Nice to be back, Kai.
Job losses obviously are the signature of this recession, but the signature is a little different this time than in recessions past, no?
That's right. So the last two recessions, the recession of the early 90s and the early part of this decade in 2001, the job losses were much more even between more educated and less educated workers, whereas in the past, the brunt really fell on less educated workers. In this recession so far, we're going back to that old model, and the brunt is really falling much more on less educated workers. So we see much more job loss in construction and in retail, and the unemployment rate for workers without a college degree has gone up significantly more than the unemployment rate for workers with a college degree.
Also, you point out today, more for men than women.
Yeah, much more for men than women. You know, there's a chance that we're going to get to this point where, believe it or not, the workforce, at least the payroll workforce, people who work at jobs rather than self-employed, is going to be more than half female, which is really quite something. Every one of the most recent recessions has hit men harder than women. And the easiest way to think about it this time is just the difference between construction, which is about the hardest hit sector mm-hmm. and is overwhelmingly male, and healthcare, which is still growing and is much more female than, say, something like construction.
Is there a way to make sense of it in terms of ethnic groups, too? I mean, you point out in the paper that Latinos are being hit really hard this time.
They are. And if you go back and you look at expansions when the economy is doing well, which is most of the time, and recessions when it's shrinking, minority groups, blacks and Latinos at least, do better in expansion in terms of employment than whites. So over the last 20 years or so, the employment rates of minority groups have actually risen somewhat more than the employment rate of whites during good times. But they're hurt much more during bad times. Minorities tend to be in more cyclical industries. And again, if you think about construction, the construction workforce was heavily, heavily Latino. The unemployment rate for Latino men in this country 3 years ago or so was 3.6%, below the unemployment rate for whites. The unemployment rate for Latino men now is 11%, and that's just an unbelievable rise. It even understates what's going on because a fair number of people who've lost their jobs have gone home to Mexico or to Central America and obviously aren't counted in the unemployment statistics.
You ended your piece today on what you might call a hopeful note, that what this recession is going to do is actually collapse the difference, the spread in the wealth gap in this country.
Yeah, and there are a number of reasons for that. The first is Wall Street is not going to look what it used to look like. And Wall Street's responsible for a huge share of what economists call the upper tail inequality, the growth in the share of income of the top 1%. The second is policy. Tax rates have fallen the most for very top earners over the last few decades, the same people who've been getting the biggest pre-tax raises. And the Obama administration clearly is setting out to change that. And then education is the third piece. The absolute best thing that could come out of this recession would be a real surge in educational attainment. If you get more educated people, what happens is not only does the economy grow quicker, but you also have more people who are essentially sharing in the bounty that comes with being more educated. And so a more educated population tends to be a less unequal population.
David Leonhardt is a columnist for the New York Times. He's a staff writer at the Times Magazine as well. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Now that we know what the president wants to do to help homeowners facing foreclosure, there is a whole other side of the real estate meltdown that's got to be dealt with, too. The hundreds of thousands, or millions, maybe, of foreclosed properties already sitting on the market and driving down home values. Congress has already thought about that. Tamara Keith reports now on another federal program aimed at soaking up all that housing inventory that nobody wants.
It's called the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, and Congress created it last summer. It helps people who don't own homes buy foreclosed homes and get them off the market. In the coming months, that program will give cities and states $4 billion. They can use it to assist buyers to buy, renovate, and rent properties, or simply to tear them down. The program is aimed at places like Prince William County, Virginia. Ruth Henriquez is a broker with Casa Latino Real Estate, and she's driving me around the city of Manassas Park.
We've driven by dozens of foreclosed homes very easily.
It's a working-class Washington, D.C. bedroom community with too many foreclosed homes and not enough buyers.
But just to give you an idea about this house, it's been on the market for 408 days. That's over a year. Anybody could come in, anybody could break a window. It's costing the bank money every day it sits.
The federal program is channeling $4 million to Prince William County. The county plans to use the money to help people with small incomes buy these now bargain basement houses and fix them up. Elijah Johnson is the county's director of housing.
We want to make sure that we can get those units off the market, back into that investment pool to help that homeowner and help that neighborhood be a viable neighborhood.
But here's the thing. Prince William County has some 2,000 foreclosed homes on the market. And Johnson figures he has enough funding to rescue maybe 50.
With the magnitude of foreclosures, I don't think any jurisdictions will say they got enough money.
But he's not complaining. The money will be targeted in 10 neighborhoods with the biggest problems.
It's a kind of a bowling effect. You hit the front pin, everything starts going, and that's what we're trying to create here.
And do you think it's going to work?
I'm sure it's going to work.
We're trying to stop the bleeding and make these houses homes again.
Brian Sullivan is with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. HUD is passing out the money. In cities like Cleveland and Detroit, a chunk of the funds will be used to demolish blighted homes.
It's designed to be targeted to a very particular category of property, the property that goes into foreclosure and stays that way.
Back in Manassas Park, realtor Ruth Henriquez has a stack of listings printed out that she believes would be perfect candidates for the program. But Manassas Park has only been allotted a pittance, $86,000.
And the sad part is I've already showed you several homes, and the program's not going to help this many homes.
The Neighborhood Stabilization Program is about to get a bit more money. The economic stimulus package included an additional $2 billion to spread around. I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, once again, straight from the lips of new Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz. She is known for speaking her mind. Last week, we told you how she's promising to get Yahoo kicking, well, butt again. It wasn't anatomy that put Bartz back in the news today. It was how she navigates. At a tech conference in San Francisco, Bartz fessed up that she doesn't use Yahoo Maps to get around. Google is the choice. The company tried to spin it as Maps being too expensive to invest in when Yahoo's got so many other problems. But you can say this for Bartz. Whatever she is saying, it seems to work. Yahoo shares were up 5% today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 149 points, 2.25%. The NASDAQ gained 32 points, 2.5%. The S&P 500 added 20 points. That is nearly 3% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, and Jeff Peters engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, lifestyles in Dubai shift into a lower gear.
So this is her. She purrs nicely and was a symbol of where I was going. Now it's a symbol of where I didn't go.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.